That's a power quartet, if ever there was one. McCoy Tyner on piano and three incredible sidemen, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Ron Carter on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums with Contemplation. That's from the album The Real McCoy, recorded in 1967. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, April the 28th, and quite a bit to get two on our agenda today, so let's get started. President Obama is in the Philippines today and tomorrow, the final stop on a four-nation visit with heads of state in the Asia-Pacific region. Last week, he went to Japan, South Korea, and Malaysia. Well, the good thing is that diplomacy is usually about what is not seen and what is not heard, and we are so lucky to have as a guide to unearth both things for us, Dr. Gerald Horn, who has been helping us understand world events from an entirely different perspective. He joins us now. Dr. Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He is a prolific author, to say the least, 30 books and counting, and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. He teaches undergraduate courses in the civil rights movement and U.S. history, and graduate courses in diplomatic history, labor history, and 20th century African-American history. His latest book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, has just been released, and he is going to be doing book signings in St. Louis, Berkeley, Santa Barbara, and Los Angeles, for those of you living in those cities. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's hear first how this visit was described from Arirang News, and we'll hear right after that, we would hear the misgivings of a protester in the Philippines.
Now, moving on to some other news, U.S. President Barack Obama is now in Tokyo on the first stop of a week-long trip to Asia.
He's currently meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, where North Korea and economic ties are expected to top the agenda, Kim Ji-on reports.
During his eight-day four-nation tour of Asia, U.S. President Barack Obama will attempt to reaffirm America's commitment to its allies on the other side of the Pacific. In Japan, Obama will try to convince Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe that he can deliver on his security and economic pledges. An existing defense treaty between the two countries requires the U.S. to come to Japan's defense if it is attacked. Tokyo claims that treaty extends to Islands at the center of a dispute between Japan and China, which puts the U.S. in a tough position. Obama is walking a fine line as he tries to ease Tokyo's concerns while not upsetting Beijing. Local media outlets in Japan are reporting that the U.S. opposes any attempts to undermine Japan's administration of these islands. The two leaders will also discuss the stalled negotiations on a Trans-Pacific trade agreement. After finishing up in Tokyo, Obama will come to Seoul, where he will meet with President Park Geun-hye at 1 p.m. local time on Friday. He is to express his sympathy to the victims of the South Korean ferry disaster. The two leaders will also talk over ways to respond to the North Korea threat, particularly with the possibility of a fourth nuclear test from Pyongyang looming. President Obama is also expected to express his support to President Park's vision on reunification of the two Koreas. In a speech in Dresden last month, she urged the North to expand reunions of families separated by the Korean War and increase cross-border economic and cultural exchanges, which include the South bolstering humanitarian aid. This is Obama's fourth visit to South Korea, which represents the most trips to the nation by a sitting U.S. president. After departing from Seoul, Obama will head to Malaysia and the Philippines. Kim Ji-yeon, Arirang News.
U.S. President Barack Obama jets off to Asia with a cheery wave as he boards Air Force One. His presence isn't as welcome in some of the nations he plans to visit as he might have hoped. Obama's first port of call is Tokyo. Trade talks are top of the agenda. But his impending arrival has triggered protests by some who object to plans for a multilateral Pacific trade pact and others who simply feel the etiquette's not right. These protesters in Manila are unhappy about an imminent military agreement that will boost the presence of U.S. troops in the Philippines. Scuffles broke out as riot police stopped them approaching the U.S. Embassy compound.
It is an affront to our sovereignty. It brings back foreign bases. It reinforces, increases foreign troops. It's like a second U.S. military occupation or a second colonization of the country.
Obama's expected to use his four-nation trip to reassure key allies like Japan and South Korea that their alliance is as strong as ever. At the same time, he needs to avoid damaging relations with increasingly powerful China, which is locked in regional territorial disputes with several nations.
Well, two reports that stress that although the United States has a pretty lofty stated purpose in the president's visit, there is a flip side to that. Perhaps you can start there, Gerald. What is the flip side to all the good news and all the positive reports about what the president is supposed to be doing in the Pacific Rim region?
A central purpose of Mr. Obama's trip was part of a larger U.S. plan to have an encirclement of China. It's no secret that certain economists are already projecting that perhaps within this decade, certainly within the next two decades, the Chinese economy will be substantially larger than that of the United States. And there are those in Washington who feel that that poses a major strategic challenge to U.S. hegemony globally. Hence, this trip, particularly to Japan, which already has major problems with China, that is to say, with regard to territorial disputes and all the rest. The problem for the White House and the problem for the United States is that South Korea, which was another stop along this route, probably has worse relations with Japan than it does with China. In fact, South Korea-China relations are very close. South Korean popular culture is wildly popular in China. I'm speaking of music, soap operas, and things of that sort. So it's going to be very difficult to get South Korea to join its former colonial master, Japan, in an alliance against China when relations between South Korea and China already are so close. And then there are other wrinkles, too, that need to be considered. For example, Mr. Obama's other primary objective was knocking together this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, which can be described roughly and crudely as another form of NAFTA, that is to say the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, except much larger. The problem there is that Japan
is not willing to open its markets in the auto area to U.S. exports of cars from Ford and General Motors. And likewise, Japan is not willing to open its agricultural markets to U.S. exports, particularly with regard to the sensitive commodity that is rice. Not only that, but there are credible rumors that are out there that I should report, in all fairness, to your listeners. The rumor is this, that supposedly there are talks taking place between Japan and North Korea with regard to these allegations that over the years the North Koreans have been abducting Japanese nationals. But supposedly, and here's the rumor, these talks about abductions are in some ways a cover for more engaged relations emerging between North Korea and Japan, which is hard to contemplate at this point, given the enmity between these two nations. But consider that the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, when he executed or was said to have executed his uncle and had a general purge in recent months, that supposedly this was a purge of pro-Beijing elements in the highest levels of the Workers' Party that now rules North Korea, and that this purge was a prelude to warming relations with Tokyo. And not only that, but if you look at Japan, the most vocal and strongest minority is the minority of Korean descent, and that minority is quite close, at least in the leadership levels, to the North Korean regime. And they are also said to be part of this engagement process. Now, if this takes place, it could have the kind of impact that, say, the Nixon to China visit had some four decades ago. So I'm saying all this to say that despite the administrations of the White House and Mr. Obama personally, I'm not sure if this plan, this trip to Asia, is working out according to the original script.
Well, to follow on that point, it seems to me that, in fact, the president arrived in the region and immediately we began to see that there was, on their own volition, it seems, without the U.S. input as middleman, if you will, these Asian countries and Pacific Rim countries were basically organizing their own detente, if you will. They were in the process of kind of getting their own act together, dealing with the enmity, as you see, with between South Korea and Japan over the islands, dealing with the North-South. They had begun a discussion about unifying the North-South in the sense that they would allow visits from the South to the North and relatives to be in touch with each other. So did I misread this, that the region seemed, and you know, the Philippines had already begun their own reorganization politically, and especially in the aftermath of the major typhoon, they began to, there was some harsh words and harsh feelings about the United States in its immediate aftermath. So am I reading it wrong that there seemed to have been an effort at self-governance in the way that it had not worked before, where they were trying to overcome, even in small symbolic ways, but meaningful ways just the same, you know, except in the major issue over the land grab of these islands. But it seemed as if they were working towards some kind of understanding, a kind of self-governance.
There are other problems with the White House script that I should also mention. That is to say that relations between Washington and Beijing are rather complicated. On the one hand, you have U.S. corporations such as Apple, Microsoft, and all the rest that have enormous investments in China and are not necessarily willing to see that boat rocked. That is to say, not willing to see a downturn in U.S.-China relations because of these investments. On the other hand, there are very strong hawkish factions in the United States that would like to see the overthrow of the Chinese Communist Party. And given the fact that a number of our major domestic constituencies, I'm thinking of the black community, for example, really don't have a voice when it comes to foreign policy, although they are the stalwart and the bulwark of the Democratic Party coalition. Their absence from the field basically removes their progressive voice from foreign policy deliberations, giving more heft and muscle to the hawkish faction symbolized by John McCain, which tends to mean that U.S. policy tends to lean to the right internationally. This brings me to my second point, which is the dovetailing between events in Eastern Europe and the Asia tour. You know that a central principle of U.S. foreign policy, at least since the heyday of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, has been to drive a wedge between Russia and China. That was symbolized by President Richard Nixon's trip to China some four-odd decades ago, which in many ways set the stage for the encirclement of the Soviet Union and set the stage for the collapse of the Soviet Union. But now, given the unrest in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and given the fact that as we speak, the White House is announcing stiffening sanctions against Russia, the United States finds itself in a difficult position of, on the one hand, trying to encircle China, and on the other hand, worsening relations with Russia. This is a very difficult strategic position to be in from the point of view of national security, leading some analysts to suggest that the national security posture of the United States has not been this perilous in decades. Now, this is something that other Asian nations are examining. Not only does a nation like Japan recognize that the United States might not have the will nor the wallet to stay the course with regard to an anti-China posture, leading Japan, perhaps as already suggested, to cut its separate deal with North Korea to ease tensions on that front, but as well, it could also lead to the nightmare scenario. That is to say that President Putin is going to be visiting Japan in the fall. It's difficult to see how the sanctions regime that Washington is imposing is going to be consistent with a Putin trip to Tokyo, where inevitably relations will be warming. Not only that, but President Putin is on his way to Beijing within days, and as Washington is pressuring its European allies, such as Germany, which has 6,000 German corporations invested in Russia, and Washington is pressuring Germany to cut back on its energy reliance on Russia in terms of oil and natural gas, the problem there is that if Germany complies with Washington's request, it'll not only anger the business sector in Germany, which has so much invested in Russia, but it could potentially weaken the conservative administration of Chancellor Angela Merkel, causing the Social Democrats to come back into power, which is not something that would be greeted with warmth by the hawks in Washington. I say all this to say that the national security posture of the United States of America is becoming ever more complicated and difficult with every passing day.
But also, it seems to me that the president's trip, in the end, you can say was more symbolism than substance, because the big prize, of course, he did not get, which was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That just did not go. And now we see that despite certain moves by the United States to, you know, check Ukraine or check Russia's influence in the Pacific, Asia-Pacific countries, that they are nonetheless moving despite They're moving at a pace despite that dictated by the United States. They have their own ways of doing things, and they're going about their own ways of doing things with a specific geopolitical outlook that emphasizes their unique needs and not those of the United States.
Well, yes, you have a point there. And I should also mention that despite the apparent failure to nail down this Trans-Pacific Partnership, the fact of the matter is that as we speak, there are free trade talks taking place between Japan, South Korea, and China. Despite the tensions between Beijing and Tokyo, they're still having talks with regard to a free trade area, which is a reflection of the fact that Japan's leading trading partner, despite all the tensions and friction, remains China. So it's not good news on Washington nor on Wall Street that free trade talks between these three Asian giants are seemingly on a fast track, while the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has basically hit an iceberg. And this could not come at a more inopportune moment for Washington. Your listeners may want to find on YouTube the press conference that took place a few weeks ago between Pentagon Chief Chuck Hagel and his Chinese counterpart in Beijing. Quite frankly, I thought that these two men were going to settle tensions between their respective countries on the spot by way of hand-to-hand combat, which gives you an idea of the friction and tensions between the two nations. The apparent general inability to have this encirclement plan of China nailed down by the Obama trip is suggestive of suggesting the difficulties that Washington is facing. And even though apparently there was a new base agreement with the Philippines, that is to say the United States will be rotating in and out more U.S. troops in the Philippines, I'm not sure if that compensates for these other problems that I've already sketched and outlined.
Well, that, let's stick with this for 1 minute more, and that is the outward anger and protest. I mean, this is also, in a way, kind of unusual, because these societies tend to be quite polite, even if they don't agree with the United States, and their governments are very effective in curtailing outward showing of opposition to the visitor. That is an impolite thing to do. But the strength and force of the protest in the Philippines suggests something really interesting about how Filipinos are seeing the political tentacles of the United States stretching back again into the region, and they don't like it. So how does
well, as
does
you know, the
president?
United States ousted Spain from colonial administration of the Philippines as a result of the War of 1898, and there was a very star-crossed relationship between Washington and Manila for decades. But there is another aspect to this trip that unfortunately the press has not highlighted. If you look at two of the key stops on this trip, I'm speaking of the Philippines and I'm speaking of Malaysia, it's striking to note that the leading business sectors in both of those countries are basically led and managed by Malaysians and Filipinos of Chinese descent. Over the years and over the decades, this has led to a certain amount of tension and friction. That is to say, the fact that Chinese Filipinos and Chinese Malaysians dominate the commanding heights of the economy. When Mr. Obama comes to Kuala Lumpur and comes to Manila seeking to sign up these two nations to an anti-China encirclement plan, inevitably it stokes tension. And it casts light upon the Chinese Malaysian population and the Chinese Filipino population, both of which, to a degree, have seen their fortunes rise as a result of their privileged relationship with Beijing. Over the years, and in recent years, this has led to certain kinds of anti-Chinese riots that have taken place. And I would hope that the White House could be sensitive to what their anti-China encirclement plan might inadvertently engineer.
Now, what about the Islamic factor? This is a region with a very large population of Muslims. And in fact, the Muslims themselves were in the Philippines and in Malaysia, they were not happy about the United States position in with respect to the Islamic world. To what extent did the United States foreign policy in the Middle East leak over into the president's visit in the region?
Well, certainly that's true for Malaysia. which has a substantial Islamic population. Even though Mr. Obama did not visit Indonesia, where you may recall he spent some of his early years, the fact is that Indonesia is the largest predominantly Islamic nation in the world today. And despite what we have been told is a personal affection for Mr. Obama, given the fact that he spent part of his childhood in Indonesia, and despite the fact that Indonesia, too, is sensitive to the rise of China, and like Philippines and Malaysia, it, too, has a business sector that is heavily dominated by Chinese Indonesians. And it is true as well that, like many predominantly Islamic nations, both Malaysia and Indonesia have a bone to pick with Washington with regard to its policies in Palestine, with regard to its wars that have taken place in both Iraq and Afghanistan. These are major problems that I am not sure if this in-and-out trip of Mr. Obama, whether that in-and-out trip will basically assuage those difficulties.
Well, let's look now at the Ukraine. This past week was a lot of frequent fly miles had been racked up. They were flying commercially. Joe Biden was in the Ukraine as well to assure that government that they could count on ending U.S. support, that the U.S. was right behind them and they need not fear and they need not query the commitment of the United States to supporting that government. Is it very clear what the United States wants in Ukraine at this point, except, you know, getting good political mileage out of it?
Well, certainly the situation in Ukraine is very dangerous and very perilous. There's a lot of loose talk, particularly coming out of Kiev, about how the world might be facing World War III. We need to reject that particular discourse, and we also need to remind ourselves what Albert Einstein said some years ago, which is that it's unclear how World War III would unfold, but certainly World War IV would be fought with sticks and stones. That is to say, the kind of barbarism that a war between big powers would ignite makes it fundamentally unthinkable. Yet, once again, I'm afraid that the hawkish faction in Washington is throwing gasoline on the flames. Historians of the future will no doubt want to look at the files of the White House and of, say, Senator John McCain in particular, going back to the fall of 2013, when there was a deal on the table where Ukraine could basically accept aid from both the European Union and Russia, but pressure was placed upon the Yanukovych regime then in power not to accept half of that deal, that is to say the deal with Russia, and that led, as you know, to street protests leading to its fleeing Kiev in February 2014, which has contributed to the current crisis. Because fundamentally, Ukraine, as we all know, is a split nation. That is to say, eastern Ukraine leans towards Russia, and western Ukraine leans towards Western Europe, leans towards Brussels. The United States, and I would say particularly the mainstream press, is not helping things. I'm thinking in particular of the New York Times, which just yesterday ran a front-page story about the supposed wealth of President Vladimir Putin. If you believe this story, which was based on rumors by the journalist's own admission, which makes you wonder why it was placed on the front page, but the story basically said that Mr. Putin's wealth might be larger than that of Bill Gates. And why they would print that story based upon rumors and put it on the front page, one can only come to the conclusion that they're trying to worsen the already existing and profound anti-Russian sentiments that pervade the United States of America, and therefore brings us closer to conflict with this nuclear-armed nation. It's a very dangerous situation we're now facing.
Well, just the same, it's also a crass political move because these are midterm elections that are coming up soon. Joe Biden does get to boast about his credentials as a foreign policy expert, should he run in 2016. The president is shoring up to the best of his ability the currency of the Democratic Party. And this was, it seems to me, because nothing came back of great substance, and you know, to show that, well, these were trips well worth it, other than for, you know, good public relations and, you know, great symbolism and so forth. But I'm not so sure that either Joe Biden or the president came back to the United States, the president coming back tomorrow, will be able to say what they have achieved in this past week with all these foreign policy forays.
Well, there are two structural problems with regard to U.S. foreign policy. One has already been noted, which is that the black community, which is a bulwark of the Democratic Party, is basically absent from the foreign policy conversation, not least because some decades ago a deal was brokered whereby in return for throwing overboard the foreign policy-oriented black leadership led by Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, in return for that purge of their influence, civil rights concessions would flow. And that's the deal that still obtains in the United States, even though the Supreme Court's recent decisions on affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act tend to suggest that the other side has basically reneged on their side of the bargain, yet the black leadership finds itself incapable and unable to renege on its side of the bargain. It's basically absent from the foreign policy conversation, which gives more strength to the right wing and to the hawks, thereby helping to hamper and handcuff the hand of any Democratic Party administration, be it led by Barack Obama or be it led by Joe Biden. The other aspect that needs examination is the fact that as a direct result of the Cold War, which basically led to a profound escalation of anti-Moscow sentiments, and basically it also led to a situation that we face today where anti-Russian sentiments also pervade a good deal of the U.S. left, because during the Cold War, if the U.S. left did not take an anti-Moscow vow, they could find themselves either under indictment or losing their jobs or otherwise, quote, blacklisted, unquote. And that particular aspect of U.S. life has yet to disappear, which also suggests that the U.S. left is not in an advantageous position as well to challenge the hawks policy on Ukraine. And the other not-so-minor detail is that if you go back and look at the genesis of this crisis in the fall of 2013, you'll find that State Department official Victoria Nuland was key with regard to the worsening of relations between Russia and the United States, and she happens to be, for what it's worth, the spouse of the godfather of neoconservatism, Robert Kagan. Now, you may ask yourself how such a conservative figure could find herself at the loftiest heights of the U.S. State Department. But I refer you to what I just said. When the black community is absent from foreign policy conversations, the U.S. left is handcuffed by its pre-existing Russophobia, it makes it easier for Victoria Nuland to ascend to the highest levels of U.S. foreign policy making.
How is the Jewish community, in your view, responding to the fact that the United States has allied itself with Nazi elements in Ukraine?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I should also say that I would hope that many of our friends in the Jewish community would also be looking at what's going on in Hungary today, not so far from the Ukraine, where anti-Semitic ultra-rightist forces are surging into influence, particularly as a result of most recent elections. I would hope minimally it would make our friends in that community go back and look at their policies towards Eastern Europe over the past few decades, which has basically led to a resurgence of anti-Semitism and ultra-rightism. But interestingly enough, if you look at the policy of Israel, which for better or for worse oftentimes sets the pace for many of our friends, but not all, in the Jewish community, you find that the Israeli administration is very circumspect with regard to Ukraine. When the United Nations General Assembly voted to condemn Russian policy with regard to that part of the world, you may recall that there were a number of abstentions and a number of those nations not voting. Israel was in the latter category. It did not vote. And this is due to a number of factors. One, the coalition led by Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, is heavily dependent upon voters and votes from a Russian community that migrated to Israel after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And many Russians across the spectrum were not necessarily hostile to the annexation of Crimea. And Mr. Netanyahu has to be sensitive to that. But not only that, Israel tends to conduct an independent foreign policy, if you like, even though it's oftentimes portrayed as some kind of puppet of Washington. Keep in mind, for example, that there have been credible allegations that Israel has leaked sensitive and complicated and complex U.S. military technology to the People's Republic of China, which we've already suggested the United States is trying to encircle right now. And so these are factors that need to be considered when we answer the question you just posed.
Well, I want to thank you again for an impeccable tour. You really basically give us a view of foreign policy in a way that nobody presents it. I think that, Gerald, you are unique in this respect. You have an extraordinary grasp of foreign policy and diplomatic history. And so you, and of course, imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism, and it all comes together very neatly in your brain, which is, I think, singular in this regard. I don't know anybody else who knows the subject as well as you do. But it's great to be your student and to have you course us through these complex issues. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Just to remind you, Gerald Horn's latest book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, has just been released, and Gerald will be doing book signings in St. Louis, Berkeley, Santa Barbara, and Los Angeles. So you want to check for those cities if you are there to make sure you go see him and get a copy of his book. And, of course, he'll be here talking about the book as well. We'll take this short break and come back to a moment in history that we need to remember. Piano, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Ron Carter on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums with Contemplation from the year 1967. And I specifically chose that because 1967 is going to occupy our attention for the next couple of minutes. It is on this day in 1967 that heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, then a member of the Nation of Islam, refused to be drafted into the U.S. Army on the grounds that it violated his religious beliefs. We will hear in his own words his explanation for defying the law, but it was a battle that would cost him dearly, even though the U.S. Supreme Court in 1971 would overturn a lower court conviction, I said conviction, by an all-white jury on draft evasion charges. We'll hear these snippets from interviews that Ali did And you get a very clear understanding of the evolution of this man, this intellectual evolution, and his resolve. And there's a certain kind of purity, a certain kind of undeniable pride and courage in how he reasoned his position. So let's listen to Muhammad Ali just taking us through his thinking.
Now, I want to trace back to where a bomb went under your boxing career, because suddenly it all went wrong. Presumably this was the Vietnam question and the army draft. You are called up for the army. You take two tests and you fail them. And then suddenly the matter goes to the Pentagon, because you are you. You were then Cassius Clay. You were Muhammad Ali, but you were a famous figure. And suddenly, you, the man who failed two tests, were passed A1. Is that true? Is that how it
happened? Well, yes, they said I was mentally deficient or something, because I didn't pass my tests twice.
Yeah, tell me about those tests.
One test was in Miami. Old test, like if you had 15 apples and you sold 2 1/4 of these apples and 3/3 of these apples was destroyed, how many do you have left? I don't know the answer. I barely got through school. I'm not really a good reader nor a good speller. You have a time limit on all the tests. And most of them I just guessed, because I was too embarrassed to say I couldn't read the test that quick. So they had two psychiatrists came from Washington, D.C., took me to Kentucky, and they examined me to see if I was joking, and they found that the same test corresponded with the first one. So then this is still when I was Cassius Clay and a Christian, but after the Islamic the Muslim faith was pronounced that I had joined, and the name Muhammad Ali, then all of a sudden I became wise. Then they lowered the standard that anybody who made at least 18 on their test, which was awful low, must go to the army. Well, this got me, see. Yeah.
Now, did they do this because of you, do you think?
Well, I really don't know. It's hard to believe that such a powerful government and a country like America would change a whole system just to get one black man in service.
You don't only have to say one thing in this country, and you could be back in boxing tomorrow.
Yes, but I don't know. I don't think I'd have to say that. Many reasons could probably get me back. Number one, first, my case would have to be throughout, draft case. If they don't do that, I'll probably have to do 4 or 5 years in prison. And then if I come out then, if I'm in shape, then I can consider it. But as of now, money means nothing to me, nor boxing, when it comes to the freedom of your people. So everything I'm doing, if it means hitchhike tomorrow, if it means be raggedy, if it means look for a job, I'll be happy, because I can go to bed, my conscience is clear, and I didn't sell out or trade my people just because I could be rich in Hollywood with a yacht out here on my... That could be my yacht right there. I imagine it's valued at $200,000, but I wouldn't want that damn yacht if I couldn't go back over in the black neighborhood and protest a black woman being raped. The hell with the lot. The hell with the championship. So I want the people to know this, you understand? The Muslims did not find me. Elijah Muhammad, God don't need me. I need him. I couldn't talk to you a few years ago when I was in England the first time on these subjects, because I wasn't as not a Muslim. I didn't have the wisdom that I have now. So if you noticed, when you talk to me, when they do interviews with me, they're not the interviews that you do with boxers. Boxers usually don't talk. And all they can tell you is he ran 5 miles yesterday, or got good left jab, or I'm not that type of Negro, black man, you understand?
Yeah.
See, the questions they asked me on interviews and in colleges is the same thing, or more complicated, than you would ask the Queen of England or President Nixon or some senator politician. So I would say that I'm awful happy, because what I'm doing now, I feel to be much greater than boxing. I mostly concentrate on my people, because after I'm finished with white America as far as sports and entertaining them, beating up a black brother of mine or something, I'll have to come back to the black ghetto. I'll have to come back to black people. All black people, I don't care how big they get, and all the entertainers in America, all the athletes, when they're down and no more wanted to entertain the power structure, the master, the millionaires, then they have to come back anyway with their own. So I'm mostly concerned with what my people think about me. See, the whites have never respected us. They've always mistreated us, assassinated us. They've always deprived us of freedom, justice, equality, and lynched and burned us. So really, they can't hate me or dislike me no more. All I want is the following of my world, the black world, which numbers some 650 million. And this is what I have now. My stand for my religious belief, my stand for my people, speaking up for my people, all of them are with me. And that's all I want.
First of all, I would like to thank the student governing body for inviting me here to speak at this beautiful and worthy occasion tonight. And I would also like to congratulate them on their great, splendid stand to stop the bloody war that's now going on in Vietnam. And as a Muslim minister, my own outlook on war and violence is well known by now. And I would like to say that the number one greeting in my faith is peace, and that is assalamu alaikum, which means may peace be unto you. There have been many questions put to me why I refuse to be inducted into the United States Army, especially as some have pointed out, many have pointed out, when not taking the step, I will lose so much. And I would like to say to those of the press and those of the people who think that I lost so much by not taking the step, I would like to say that I did not lose a thing up until this very moment. I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot. Number one, I have gained a peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart. I now know that I'm in content with Almighty God Himself, whose proper name is Allah. I have also gained the respect of everyone here today. I have not only gained the respect of everyone here today, but worldwide I have gained the respect. People all over the world. And by taking the step, may have satisfied a few people who are pushing the war. Even if the wealth of America was given to me for taking the step, the wealth of America and the friendship of all of the people who support the war, this will still be nothing if I am not content internally and if I'm not in accord with the will of Almighty Allah. As you read the newspapers and the press now, you see that I am now in court. I am in court seeking justice under the laws of the land. In this country, the United States of America, ministers are exempt from the armed services. And if they choose, I am a Muslim minister and a teacher of the religion of Islam. It has been said that I have two alternatives, either go to jail or go to the army. But I would like to say that there is another alternative, and that alternative is justice. And if justice prevails, I will neither go to the army nor will I go to jail. They say that actually every time that I enter the ring, in a way, I'm going to war. They say to me daily, you are a prize fighter. What's the difference? And I like to say to those critics of the press and to the others that there is one hell of a lot of difference in fighting in the ring and going to war in Vietnam. Boxing is nothing like going to war with machine guns, bazookas, hand grenades, bomber airplanes. My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people. That's what the business is in war. I would like to hear this from you. And I want the world and the cameras to hear. Who's the heavyweight champion of the world? And I'm very pleased and thankful for being here. And that's all I would like to say. Thank you very much.
Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now, right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemies are white people, not Vietcongs or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Muhammad Ali making his case in his own words, and you can tell from the clarity that he presents his case that he was not at all confused about his allegiances nor about his religious beliefs. He was very clear about that. He remains the same in character today. And I thought it was instructive that Ali would take this position, not for himself, but for a larger purpose, as he put it. It was important, and in fact imperative to him, that he take the stand in behalf of himself, of course, but in behalf of all African Americans similarly situated in this paradox of the United States, where you're going to be sent abroad to fight for freedom and democracy, which they did not enjoy at home. I want to thank you for joining me today. I hope this was meaningful to you and that you found some kind of value in it. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And I want to encourage you to write me a note. Tell me what you're thinking about the programs. Are you enjoying them? Do they have value to you? Are they the kinds of programs that you would like to continue hearing? Definitely give me a yell via email at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I want to thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company today. Take care.